And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode 31. Adam Gerke here, Tim Hall, Sarah Michelle Fetters.
Hello.
And welcome back, Tim.
Welcome back, Tim.
Thanks
no Brian Zitzelman tonight.
That's
Brian
all right.
Brian is out. We upgraded. Yeah, we did, as a matter of fact.
Don't tell him I said that, though.
Right. It's a perfect crime.
Yeah, like nobody will ever know that I said that we upgraded from Brian Zitzelman.
Yeah, lots to talk about tonight. We've got Batman v Superman. We've got Midnight Special. We've got Eye in the Sky, Alan Rickman's last film. And also, let's just jump right into the old films tonight. Greek Wedding 2.
My big fat Greek Wedding 2. So, the sequel that nobody wanted, yet everybody seems to have wanted.
I don't know if nobody wanted this, because My Big Fat Greek Wedding 1 was a tremendous hit, as you reminded us, Sarah.
Tremendous is not the right word. So if you remember, in April of 2002, My Big Fat Greek Wedding was released on like 100 screens in the United States.
Yeah.
Nobody thought it was going to do much of anything. It's this little movie made by nobody. This woman called Nia Vardalos, who's starring in it, who's producing it, who wrote the script.
Yeah.
It looks like a sitcom.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Turns out how many millions?
$240 million in the United States alone.
Yeah, and it just kind of kept on. It was like the freight train that nobody expected.
It played for a year.
Yeah.
In theaters, it played for an entire year. It is the most financially successful romantic comedy in the history of motion pictures.
So flash forward 14 years?
Yes.
Am I get the numbers on that right?
14 years later.
They decide to remake, basically, My Big Fat Greek Wedding with a slight twist. So the Portokalos family
is back.
They're back in all of their glory. Everybody's back.
Everybody is back.
Same writer, Nia Vardalos.
Who is still hooked up with John Corbett.
Right. So she's,
everybody's hunky.
She's playing
Northern Exposure guy.
She's playing Tula. He's playing Ian. Yep. But this time, we're actually going to look at Mom and Dad, Gus and Maria.
Yes.
So Michael Constantine and Lianne Kazan. So
Lainey Kazan.
Excuse me. So Lainey Kazan. I was getting too ethnic all at once, I suppose.
I know you were. It's awesome.
So what happens is we've basically got this situation where Grandma and Grandpa, or Mom and Dad, as it were, turns out they're not married.
No, the
their marriage certificate was never signed.
Yeah, the priest that was going to sign them forgot to do it because they were on the boat to come to the U.S. 50 years prior. So it's their 50th anniversary.
So we've got to have
they're not married.
And we've got to have a wedding. And
exactly.
It takes a dysfunctional, big Greek family to put on a family wedding.
Exactly.
Chaos ensues.
Of course. But, you know, also remember their 17-year-old daughter, Paris, played by newcomer Elena Kampouros, is that correct? Kampouros?
I think that's right. That sounds Greek enough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The big thing between, you know, for her parents is she needs to go to college and she wants to go to NYU and they want her to go to Northwestern.
Yeah. So is she going to stay local or is she going to go fly far, far
away?
We won't spoil any of that for you. We can tell you is
it's still a sitcom.
It's still a sitcom. It's still a rom-com. Does it live up to My Big Fat Greek Wedding? You hated My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yes, I hated My Big Fat Greek Wedding 1. I kind of thought it was rather terrible, but it was a forgettable and a harmless terrible, so I haven't really thought of it in 14 years.
Uh-huh.
This movie, it's pretty much more of the same. If you liked the first movie, there is no reason to suspect you would not like the second movie. It is almost the exact same film. Yeah. It's perfectly harmless. It's also perfectly forgettable.
Yeah, I would say I'm right in line with that. And if you've ever come from a big family, you will see the family dynamics. Doesn't matter if you're Greek, if you're Jewish, if you're Catholic, you will see it in, you will see the reflections and parallels in so many ways. I thought what was actually the most entertaining for me on this film was actually the audience reaction.
Sure.
Because the film, the screening we were at was full of a number of Greek family members. And so they all got the inside humor and the jokes, and even then some that weren't.
Yeah, and I give Vardalos a little bit of credit. Her screenplay does touch on a few modern things. I mean, you know, she's working back at her dad's restaurant again. And if people remember from the first film, she had her own business. So this movie does actually touch on the 2008 economic downturn. It talks about gay marriage. It talks about Greece's financial crisis. It does bring up a lot of current events.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it does it in a very harmless sitcom-y way.
Yeah.
I don't mean that to sound as a slam. It's just what it is.
Yeah.
What stops it from being like that really good comedy that maybe people hoped it would be?
Well, I think this
the
is
the same thing that stops the first one from being that really great comedy that everybody hoped it would be.
It's not that rip-roaring, fast-cutting comedy that I think a lot of us have come to expect so much. This is a much more watered down version, right, that you would maybe expect your parents to like. And so,
yeah, but it's, 'cause comedy's changed, especially in film in the last 14 years.
Certainly has. Yeah. We've seen that with anything that Judd Apatow and his crew or any of those others have put out more recently, where it's just a different angle altogether. Sarah, you're giving us the twitchy nose.
No, I think the reason this movie doesn't work is because it revels in platitudes and stereotypes. It's just a melodramatic, sitcom-y, lowest common denominator film that doesn't really bother trying to craft characters.
I wouldn't go so far as lowest
common. Is it a plane movie? Like something that you would watch on a plane and be fine?
It's a harmless film. Mm-hmm. There's nothing great about it. There's nothing terrible about it. Mm-hmm. It just is. The reason a great romantic comedy is great is because it crafts three-dimensional, concrete, interesting characters that you want to see fall in love. Mm-hmm. This movie could care less if it does that. It just wants to put together fun situations that people are going to laugh at over 90 minutes. It's basically the Full House of romantic comedies.
So where do you sit? Theater rent or skip on this one?
It's, for me, it's a skip. Okay. If you like the first one, you're going to go see it no matter what I say.
Sure. And I'll say this is a fair rental on that regard, purely out of the fact that I think because it is forgettable, because it is popcorn, it's light, airy, you're not going to spend the farm on it, but you can still enjoy it. So I put that in the rental category. And Tim, you did not get a chance to
check
this out.
I went on a date to see the first one, though. That I remember.
Okay. So this could be a potential date number two, 14
years
later.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe I'll call her up. She's not married.
Hey, perfect crime, right? Sarah, tell us a little bit about Eye in the Sky. This is Alan Rickman's last film.
I believe it's his last film. I'd need to go check on IMDb double check he doesn't have something else in the pipeline that might be coming out towards the end of the year. But basically, so Eye in the Sky is it's a drone procedural / thriller. Mm-hmm. It has Helen Mirren as Colonel Catherine Powell. She's a British military officer who's in charge of their drone program, and she is working in consort with with the United States while they're eavesdropping on some terrorists. One of the terrorists is a British subject. Mm-hmm. Another of the potential terrorists is an American subject.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh.
And the idea is they are going to capture them, and they're using the drone because they have a military operation in place that they're going to actually capture all of these people. But what happens is the terrorists go to an isolated location that nobody expected them to.
Huh.
And because of that, she wants to give the order for the drone to strike. That instead of capturing, we are now going to kill. Mm-hmm. And so the whole movie becomes about this conversation of, is it okay to kill these people with a drone strike when you know that they are terrorists? It's revealed that there's some suicide vests on the premises.
Right.
We know that once the principals inside this location leave, they are probably going to go to some crowded place, blow themselves up. There's going to be a lot of death that's going to happen. They are terrorists. It's confirmed. We know that they are terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also in the middle of a tiny little village. There's a little girl outside the side door selling bread. There will be collateral damage.
Yeah.
And so is it okay to launch this drone strike to get people that you know are going to go kill other people if you are going to end up killing a little girl potentially in the process?
Right.
That's the movie.
Well, war does have its casualties, right? Does it not?
Well, but that's the discussion. I mean, if you remember, there was the drone thriller from last year, Good Kill with Ethan Hawke, that was primarily about what it was like for one of those drone pilots doing this day after day after day after day.
Yeah.
This movie is more, Alan Rickman is a British general who is working with some British politicians having to make the decision of yes, no, maybe.
Right.
Helen Mirren's the one in the bunker saying, we need to do this. Aaron Paul is the drone pilot over in the United States who's tasked with actually dropping the bomb.
Yo, Mr. White, I'm going to drop this bomb.
Yeah, and he's, of course, having some issues with this because, you know, he and his co-pilot are sitting there staring at this little girl that's sitting right outside the building that they're about to blow up and knowing she will probably die.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee, but probably more than likely based on what they know. And that's the whole movie. It's really well structured. It's nicely done. It actually comes up with some really good elements for you to think about. There's a lot there to chew on. It's certainly a return to form for director Gavin Hood, who a few years ago made that excellent film Saatsi. But then followed that up with X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, you know, he does a real nice job here. It's a very even-handed film. Mm-hmm. Rickman is fantastic. Mirren is fantastic. And it's also a reminder that Aaron Paul deserved all the kudos that he got for Breaking Bad. He's very good as well. I think the movie at times wants to have its cake and eat it too, mm-hmm. where it wants to make these broad points about military intervention using drone strikes, how it is such a gray area, but then it'll suddenly have these long-winded speeches about, well, you're not a soldier, you're just a politician, you don't understand what the cost of war really is, trying to sort of tilt the scale towards dropping the bomb is a good thing. And then it ends with this really bizarre closing credit montage of a little girl hula hooping as if it's kind of lingering on the fact that we may or may not have just murdered her.
Right.
So it's an odd film. So I do think it's worth seeing. I think it's worth seeing. I do think it's actually worth seeing in a theater. It's a strong enough film with enough to think about and ponder. I think you should give it a look. If only thing, just to be reminded that Alan Rickman was a ferocious talent and who could do just about anything.
The thing you were pointing out as well, this has been out in Seattle for a little while.
Yeah, it just goes wide this week. So if you haven't had a chance, more than likely the majority of your markets are going to be getting it this week.
Right.
We were lucky here in Seattle that we had it in a couple theaters for the last 2 weeks, and it goes wide, I think like almost 2,000 theaters this weekend.
Right. IMDb slates this actually as a 2015 film.
Wow, so it's been in camp
for a while.
So
it's been around for a while. And also, you are correct, this is Alan Rickman's last film as an on character presence. He did a short as well, a video short.
Oh, and he's one of the voices
voice
for
the caterpillar in the blue caterpillar in Alice Through the Looking Glass,
which
we have yet to actually see. So we won't actually see him on camera, but we'll have his delightful voice, which was always also one of just his kind of magical characteristics. Another sort of film of magical characteristics. How about this, The Midnight Special? Like how I tie that together?
You did. Yes. You tied that together real well. So Midnight Special is the new movie from Jeff Nichols. Mm-hmm. He's the writer director here. Jeff Nichols is known for Shotgun Stories, Mud, Take Shelter.
Mm-hmm. Really loved Mud. Mud was one of my favorites.
Well, I really love Take Shelter.
And Take Shelter is one of the best films of the last few years.
This has potential. This has the hallmarks of something that could be really, really great.
Oh, yeah. So this movie, I'm going to leave the plot synopsis really simple.
Yes.
A father kidnaps his own son from a religious cult, goes on a road trip where with a military friend.
State Patrol trooper.
State Patrol trooper.
Okay. That's nothing.
Picks up the boy's mother as they road trip to Florida. Something strange is going to happen in Florida, and the U.S. government wants to stop them from getting there.
Right.
Right.
I don't really want to say any more than that. I don't want to say any more than that.
That leaves the magic, that leaves the supernatural, leaves all the fun to it in its place without giving anything really away.
There, you know, you can say that this movie is kissing cousins with both Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Starman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Along with Thelma and Louise.
And I also find a heavy, heavy biblical influence.
Yes.
Right.
But that's kind of
smattered throughout the entire story.
But you know, it's funny, we talked about this before we recorded, but that entire influence makes sense when you realize, you know, the more time this movie spends around Alton was his name, right?
Yes, the little kid.
Yeah, the more time the film spends around his character, the more you realize, oh, I get why this is the reaction people are having. I get why people are culty. I get why the U.S. government wants to catch up to him. I get why his father wants to be a father and take care of his son. And it's really great that he's this character who's different things to different people at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it all makes sense. And none of it feels jumbled or mixed up.
I think what you just said there was the core of the whole film, in that, like Jeff Nichols' previous three films, this is another story about family, but even more specifically, it is a father's relation with his son and a mother's relationship with her son. And it's the letting go process.
Right.
And that process when you have to say to yourself, my child needs to go out into the world and make something of themselves on their own, and I need to be okay with that. Now, this happens obviously way early for these two parents. Right. You know, most parents, this is going to happen when they're either in high school or when they're in college. It's going to happen later on. This is happening with a kid who is 8 years old.
Yeah, and she even mentioned it. She says, you know, she struggled with watching someone else raise her son.
Yes.
And it's you know, all the characters are very humanized. Even the conversation about the state trooper that Joel Edgerton's
character
has. And we should
say, let's point, Michael Shannon is playing the father.
Yeah. Joel Edgerton is the friend.
Yes.
The state patrol trooper. Kirsten Dunst is the mother.
And they're all fantastic.
The kid is Jaden...
Newcomer.
Lieberer.
He's great.
Or excuse me, Lieber. Yeah. Lieber.
Lieberher.
It's I before E in Germanic, so that would be, it is not the Einstein, so it's Lieberher.
Ah, okay, Lieberher. Well, there we go.
Yeah. So Jaden Lieberher. So there you go.
One thing I loved about Alton's character is, as the movie goes on, he has more and more confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The way he's speaking to people, the way he's saying what needs to happen. And
he's gaining his understanding of the world.
Yes, and giving everyone around him sort of an ease. And I also love, like, the way people describe their interactions with him.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't really in awe, but they were kind of like...
They're seeing something fantastic. They know something fantastic is about to happen.
Like Adam Driver's character. He has that interaction. We don't really see what happens.
And we should say Adam Driver is playing the chief scientist that is tracking them.
Right.
Right. He's a member. He's
the NSA, right?
He's an NSA operative who wants to get a hold of Alton.
Mm-hmm.
And then we should leave it at that again. We don't want to go too much into what his character actually does. What I love about Jeff Nichols is he understands human relationships on such a profound level that he gets that he doesn't have to spell things out.
Mm-hmm.
He can leave things a little ephemeral. He can leave things a little esoteric. And that we, as fellow human beings, are going to put those pieces together. We're going to put our own lives, our own experiences, who we are as our own kind of individuals into those shoes.
Yeah.
And we're going to find a way to relate to Kirsten Dunst. We're going to find a way to relate to Michael Shannon. We're going to find a way to relate to Joel Edgerton that allows the core relationship between those three people and Alton to become even stronger.
Right.
I will say, I think, and I actually had this conversation with Jeff Nichols when I interviewed him for the film, I do think he maybe spells things out a little too much at the very end, and I don't want to get into that because I think that's something that audiences need to experience for themselves. But I also understand why he does it, because you know, the movie is such a mood and puzzle piece that you do have to give audiences something to grab onto at a certain point.
Right.
But for me, I mean, it's almost too much at the end as far as what he decides to show us.
Right.
There are a lot of almost incomplete sentences or scenes that we see throughout this film. Tim, did you get a sense of this as well, where you see, we're given this setup here, like, for instance, producer Sprintz is next to me in the film, and there's a scene, things are getting really, really tense, and cut.
Mm-hmm.
We don't necessarily know how things are going to end in this, or we're alluded to.
You know what I like? After those scenes, you would always see sort of the product of that.
Yes.
You know, I won't spoil anything, but the Adam Driver scene, later on, you kind of get a sense of what may have happened.
Right.
Because his mood has changed and how he deals with them. So, yes, but I also think, kind of to what Sarah was saying, like, you don't necessarily have to spell everything out. I think audiences are smart enough, and the film is smart enough, and it's really about the characters and the family, so you don't necessarily need to tie a bow on everything.
Mm-hmm.
You will interject your own life, your own situations, and that will sort of end those sentences for you, whatever sentence that is.
Did the movie move fast enough for you?
At the beginning, no.
Right.
I was like, because you don't know much. They're splitting time between this religious compound and this family, and you're like, what is happening?
Right.
But as things start to build up, then it all starts to make sense. Then these paths start to cross.
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. And what I think one of the fun things about this film is specifically the way it starts out. We see it's a kidnapping.
Right.
We don't understand exactly. I mean, the whole audience doesn't really understand what's going along until maybe we get a little more than a third of the way through the film and we start to realize, bigger picture.
Right.
And then it just gets bigger, 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 bigger. And
right.
I thought that was kind of a fun reveal.
But then you're like, how big is this?
Right. Yeah. Because you can't see the end of the stadium. Where's the end zone? Where am I going with this?
I think there's a sequence at a gas station where you kind of figure out how big it actually is.
Right.
Where the sky kind of falls.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
It wasn't until that was explained that I was like, now I get it. Like,
right.
Now I get what's happening.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, I think that there's a key moment where Kirsten Dunst, as you were talking about, where she sort of alludes to how hard it was for her to watch other people raise her child.
Mm-hmm.
There's a key moment there where she talks openly about what all of this has meant for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she only has like two sentences in this scene. but it's so powerfully delivered and so intimately directed that she doesn't need to say any more than these two sentences. Right. You get it all. And in a way, the entire movie is almost spelled out in that moment, and especially how the relationship between her and Michael Shannon has evolved and changed as they've taken these two different paths to raise their son.
And how about Michael Shannon? How much can that man wear on his face?
It's
wow. His ability to not say a thing, but you can just see from the way an eye twitches or the way his, you know, a grimace appears that you get exactly where he's going.
You know, one of the things I really love is, you know, they're getting help along the way, and one of the men who helps them, I think it's Michael Shannon, asks him, does he miss living on the ranch?
Yeah.
Yes.
And he has this look on his face, and he says, very much. And I wanted more of that. Like, what happens to these people, you know, who leave these situations, whether in a cult or not? You know, we saw some of it in a Scientology documentary earlier this year or last year. You see all these, you know, YouTube videos. I love that aspect of it, of like, you're uprooting yourself.
And people who have been excommunicated or cut off.
But that's one of the great things about this movie is that you could see yourself watching an entire film about a secondary subplot character. That, you know, this guy who pops up in the first 30 minutes who helps them out in this house. Just random dude.
They humanize him in like 2 seconds.
They make him interesting in about 4 seconds, and they make you kind of curious to see an entire movie just based on him and what he was doing in that compound in 10 seconds.
Yeah,
and it's everybody that you meet.
Everyone's
throughout.
Like
you could have an entire movie about Adam Driver's character. And that's just the way this movie is. I will also say Michael Shannon and Jeff Nichols together is perfection. Michael Shannon in Shotgun Stories, Michael Shannon in, especially in Take Shelter, and Michael Shannon now in this, the two of them together, perfection.
Yeah. So where do you sit on this? Theater?
I think it's a theater. Okay. I think, and it's a movie I've seen twice, and it gets better every time. I'm going theater.
Theater.
Yeah. Tim, definitely, theater? Okay, and theater. I'm with you guys. Theater, theater, theater. So a triple theater score for the Midnight Special. Fantastic. Next one, maybe a little controversial here.
Speaking of Michael Shannon, he's back in another movie.
Right. Batman v. Superman.
Dawn of Justice.
Michael Shannon's back in Batman v. Superman.
sort of.
In a non-speaking role.
In a non-speaking role, but in a very important role.
He gets residuals.
You know, it's not really a direct sequel, but it is a sequel to
direct sequel.
Is it really?
Yes, it's a direct sequel.
Man of Steel is where we're going with
it. Man of Steel, it deals with...
According to the filmmakers, it's a direct sequel.
I know. They said a lot of things recently. It's, you know, Zack Snyder is back behind the camera. And this story is, of course, as the title sequence, the title says, it is Batman v. Superman. And it picks up at the end of, the end of Man of Steel. We're sort of seeing the destruction of Metropolis. Bruce Wayne, played by Ben Affleck, is there. He witnesses all this. We do a time jump 18 months later. He's preparing for a big fight that no one really knows about but him, because he's kind of a crazy person. Then we get other stuff coming in. We get Lex Luthor, played by Jesse Eisenberg, who has a vendetta against Superman. We've got some courtroom drama with Superman having to answer for some deaths that happened in Africa. We've got Amy Adams running around with the magic bullet. And it all sort of comes together with a big fight at the end between Batman and Superman.
So there's really no mystery in that.
Not a lot of mystery.
What about that mysterious woman who just keeps coming and going throughout all these scenes,
in
though?
That is
the best part of the whole movie, you mean?
They don't really explain her well, but it is.
But she's still the
Wonder
best
Woman.
Part of the whole movie.
She's great. That was my sister's big takeaway.
Gal Gadot.
Yeah.
And
Gal Gadot.
And she's Wonder Woman.
She's Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
They call her at one point, she's only referenced as Miss Prince.
Yep.
Right.
That's the only recognition
that's
we get.
The only, yeah.
And we get some other stuff, but I won't spoil.
Well, it is subtitled Dawn of Justice, which for you DC fanatics, you should know what that means.
Well, I just remember what it means from the comic book.
Right.
The comic book, well, I want to say the comic cartoon.
Yes.
Super Friends,
of
right?
Course. Mm-hmm.
So in the Halls of Justice, and we had
everybody.
Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and...
Green Lantern and Aquaman, and the Flash.
Yeah,
all these characters.
I will say this is probably the most divisive film I've talked about in a very, very long time.
How do you say divisive?
I've heard everything from this is the best movie I've seen to this is the worst movie I've seen in 10 years.
Who said it was the best movie they've seen?
I won't give away any names.
Okay, but
to protect the innocent.
Okay,
but I've heard it all.
Were they of the Critic Society?
No.
Or is this, okay.
No.
Okay. So this is a theater goer.
Someone just like, have you seen it? Just gushing about it. I went and saw it again on Saturday with my friend who loved it.
How'd it hold up? For you on second watching, how'd it hold up?
You know, second watching, the stuff that I hated, I hated. The stuff that I love more, you know, I sort of really enjoyed it. But the holes just seem bigger mm-hmm. and more like time waste. And, you know, trying to, you know, what I had said was, you know, Snyder does all this crazy stuff, right? There's dream sequences and tons of slow-mo and yeah. weird cuts. We're not, why are we cutting here?
Yeah.
All that is fine if it's all sort of put into a story structure that works. But the story structure doesn't work. So all this other stuff you're doing just seems ridiculous.
See, yeah. and that's the key, isn't it? The movie is 151 minutes.
Right.
So it's 2.5 hours.
Right.
There is maybe 40 minutes of plot that actually relates to why Batman is worried about Superman.
That is very true.
Yeah.
So you have...
There's so much
you have maybe 2 hours of material
maybe.
That is all there just to set up other movies. It's an unwinnable situation in a way.
Mm-hmm.
This is Warner Brothers and DC setting up an entire universe to compete with Marvel.
Right.
Now, what they're forgetting about with Marvel is that Marvel took, what, 7 films?
Took them a while to dial right. it in.
Before yeah. they actually brought everybody together
right.
for one movie in the Avengers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They are trying to do all of that buildup. They're basically trying to do 6-7 films worth of buildup
mm-hmm.
in like, one movie.
In one yeah. movie.
Good luck stretch.
Because, you know, they didn't yeah. do any of that in Man of Steel. Like, Man of Steel,
no.
as much of a sequel as it's supposed to be, doesn't connect outside of the first scene in this movie, doesn't connect to the story. It feels different.
Mm-hmm.
It looks different. The whole vibe of the film is different.
Well, and that's the problem. I mean, the first scene, I actually love the first scene.
I think,
I get it. The first scene is a total knee-jerk reaction to all of us who did complain about Man of Steel and said,
right.
what the heck is with all of this violence at the end of Man of Steel, this collateral damage?
And,
this
right.
is Superman yeah. completely not caring about the thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people he just killed
yeah. right.
so this in
answers
this battle.
That, this answers that question
and
very
it's a,
quickly.
It's a total knee-jerk reaction to that.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot tell me that David S. Goyer, who co-wrote this one again,
right.
and Zack Snyder thought of that when they made Man of Steel. Now,
right.
that said, I appreciate the fact that they do address it and they address it right up front. And throwing Bruce Wayne into the middle of that is actually a great idea. And
yes.
I love how it begins. And it does yes. make you understand why Bruce Wayne would be so worried about a being as powerful as Superman.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If you were going to call this a Man of Steel sequel, though, if you were going to call this the second film in your Superman trilogy,
right.
then shouldn't your movie actually be about Superman? The majority of this movie is about Batman.
That's a strong point. And
I mean, and Affleck is great. I actually like Affleck's incarnation of the
Batman.
Dark Knight in
yeah.
this movie. But this is more of a Batman movie than it is
yeah.
a Superman movie, and it's supposed
yeah.
to be a Superman sequel.
Fun point that was actually raised by one of your friends, Sarah, was why are we seeing more of Ben Affleck with his shirt off than we are Henry Cavill, who is the Man of Steel?
Yeah.
I wanted to see more Man of Steel.
Sure.
And
he spends most of the movie being sad.
I think this is a valid point. This is if this is a Man of Steel film, we sure aren't getting a lot of Man of Steel.
And the Man of Steel we're getting is this mopey, dopey, frowny-faced, woe is me, do I actually need to save people Superman
right.
that is just a you don't want to be around him. I mean, at least you understand why Batman is morose. I mean, he's
yeah.
been fighting crime in Gotham for 20 years. He's weary. He's old. He's broken down. He sees this super being show up that just destroyed half a city and
killed his
who
friend.
Knows how many of his employees.
Yeah.
You know, you at least get why Batman is a depressed mess.
Yeah.
Superman being a depressed mess for this entire film is just weird.
You know, right. I will say my biggest issue with the film, there were a lot of things I liked. I liked Ben mm-hmm. Affleck. I liked... Gal Gadot, I thought she was great.
I can't wait to see her Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah.
I have to say,
I love Jeremy Irons.
Yeah.
I thought he was great.
He's so good.
And I also thought Lawrence Fishburne was really good. But
right.
the
if
tone,
you think something to do,
yeah, right. The tone of the film is so deeply dark
right.
that when there are beats that are supposed to move, they don't really move.
Yeah.
But
like
the big spoiler at the end just feels like a thud because it's just sort of been the same tone the entire movie. Like you need those comedic beats to sort of...
Yeah, this seems to be void of the comedic beats that we get in the Marvel world. DC's not addressing that.
But I don't have a problem. It doesn't have to be like a Marvel movie. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But what I will say, I'm going to ask you this, Tim, is one of the reasons... that Gal Gadot, that she stands out so much in this film, is that she looks like she's having fun.
Yeah.
I mean, she looks like she's enjoying herself
she's
in
smiling.
This movie.
90% of the time.
And I get that's also part of the character, but you know, when we actually finally see her in full Wonder Woman regalia, the first thing she does is smile and launch herself into battle as if she's excited to do it.
Yeah.
It's the first moment that we see somebody that actually, you know, feels like they want to do something to protect the human race.
I would love more of her, even as Diana Prince. I would love more of her instead of Amy Adams and Lois Lane running around with a bullet. We're supposed to believe Superman shot people? That's a thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's not even go to...
None of it is consistent.
There's some very odd plot machinations here that just do not work. And let's be frank. Whatever you think about Eisenberg in this movie, whether you think he's over the top and goofy or whether he actually does a good job as Lex Luthor, let's all agree, Lex Luthor's plan, A, doesn't make any sense.
No sense at all.
And B, leads directly back to him.
Yeah.
I mean, for somebody that's supposed to be as smart as Lex Luthor is...
Yeah.
Putting together a plan that is guaranteed to put you in jail seems like the most idiotic thing ever.
Just so that his hands stay clean, I think, ultimately.
But it doesn't, I mean, his hands, everything leads to him. Every single thing leads directly to him.
Yep. Yeah. Real quick then.
Okay.
Theater, rent, skip.
I think it's a theater only because if you're going to see it in a theater.
Okay.
Well, I mean, if you're going to see it in the biggest, loudest.
Yeah.
See it in real IMAX.
Yep.
See it in 70mm. I was able to see it in the actual 70mm at the Cinerama for the second time.
So, sir, where do you sit on this?
I think it's a skip, but much like Tim, the friend that I took to go see it the second time, loved it.
Right.
His wife slept through it.
Wow. Okay.
A lot of that, too. A lot of people sleeping through it.
Yeah.
And
I am more in the rental pile on this.
Right.
You know, we saw it in IMAX. I acknowledge there are some scenes that are beautiful when you see it in full IMAX, but I don't think they add anything to the overall experience. It was kind of like, and why is this in IMAX? I don't understand why this scene and not that scene was shot in this
score
format.
Like the score being really loud and they're showing Lex Luthor's shoes. Why? Yeah.
You know what? Yeah. You know what
why
I love that you bring that up, though. You know what's really weird about this movie, Adam? We saw it in IMAX, and there are sequences that are actually shot in IMAX, which is, again, different aspect ratio, right?
Right.
I enjoyed the movie more in 70mm in one aspect ratio
than seeing it
more from one to the other, because it really does look like Snyder composed it for the 70mm and the IMAX stuff is just shoehorned in there.
So comic and
but this
film.
Is our, this is our first one. This is the first comic book and well the second comic book entry for
Deadpool
the year.
Was first.
Deadpool was first. Now we've got Batman v Superman. Tim, you are our resident comic book nerd geek expert.
Really
we
Brian,
always bring you in. I know it's
here.
Really Brian, but you're just as up on it as he is. Is Batman v Superman the death knell for comic book films, or is or is this just, you know, a blip in the radar and are we still excited for the ones we have to come?
I will run down my theory in 30 seconds. Here's my theory. It might be a little long in 30 seconds. Here's my theory, though.
That's okay.
So the box office is trending one way, right? We've got these movies coming out. And then we've got more digital movies, more movies at home, more on-demand stuff. So as that is keeping people out of theaters, I think more studios are going to push for bigger movies to bring people to theaters. So we're going to get not just comic book movies, but we're going to get a lot of those and a lot of big budget sci-fi, showing in IMAX movies to try to keep people from watching movies at home. Try to give them a reason to show up.
Bigger blockbusters.
So these movies aren't going to go anywhere anytime soon.
And you know what? You just did that in 30 seconds flat.
Hey, anytime there you go.
Soon. You nailed
it. So what's this say, though, about the comic book genre in general? I mean...
We're realizing that there's a right way to do them. You know, it used to be you would get these muscle-bound people, put them in some face paint and say, here we go. And we ate it up and, you know, we made excuses. It reminds me of the line in the movie where Bruce Wayne says, you know, it only makes sense. The world only makes sense if you make it. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were doing. We were making ourselves love these movies. But since Marvel stepped on the scene with their movies, we realized you can do these movies, make them fun, make them enjoyable, and people will come see them.
What do you think that recipe for success is, though?
Yeah.
Having someone like Kevin Feige to be the point person.
So on that then, I guess my other question would be, do we give Marvel too much crap and that Batman v Superman sort of puts us a little bit in our place as to how good those films really are or how consistent those films have been? I guess that would be the way to put it.
I think, you know, when we get something like Marvel where the movies are all going to kind of have the same look and feel, there's going to be a lot of this feels a lot like another movie. Something's falling out of the sky.
Yep.
We're all teaming up. How come you're not calling the Hulk to come help you because we know he's around? You'll get a lot of that. But I will take that and for a story that makes sense. Like, you know, they're going to deal with all the fallout from other Marvel movies in Civil War next month. But I think that will make sense more than the fallout from Man of Steel that was supposed to be part of Dawn of Justice. You know, so it's a trade-off. We're going to trade off with that constantly, but I like that trade-off more than a movie doesn't make sense.
Is it weird, though, that I'm still excited about the X-Men? Because
yes.
I think Days of Future Past was kind of excellent, and I think Apocalypse looks fantastic.
So my friend Chris ruined this for me.
Okay.
I'll ruin it for you all.
Wow.
Do you realize in the X-Men movies that they do not work together when they fight?
You mean the X-Men? They're all independent fighters out there?
There's never a scene where it's like... where like Captain America's throwing his shield to Black Widow and she's fighting and then here comes Iron Man blasting off the shield. None of that ever happens.
That's not true. The first X-Men movie they do at the end, at the very end when they're getting up to the, when they're going up to the top of the Statue
thing.
Of Liberty, they actually all do work together to get Wolverine to the top.
That was two.
Oh, I know. But the other one where they actually do work together is arguably the worst film in the series, and that's X-Men 3.
Right.
The end of X-Men 3, actually all working together, and you get to see these powers in tandem. I will say that's one thing Brett Ratner actually got right with that film, is you do get to see them working in tandem. The movie is still crap.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily have a problem with that. Actually, Days of Future Past, they're working together,
like
but they're all getting killed because it's all in the future. Yeah. But, I mean, that's also part of the movie.
But you would think that they would choreograph something... that works. I'm tired of these movies all feeling like Wolverine movies. I'm tired of them all being wearing all black like they're part of some rock band. Like, give them some color. Give them something to do. Like, the X-Men are very interesting characters.
I think they have been interesting. I'm really excited about this one. I saw Stan Lee
speak at Comic-Con last year, which is coming up next weekend.
Yeah.
I saw him speak at Comic-Con last year, and he was talking about the X-Men being an allegory for the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm. Which you see in those films? Brian Singer makes that very. I mean, that's explicit
really
in those movies.
Do something interesting with that, and they kind of just.
I think
keep
they
it
do.
Loose. I don't know.
Interesting.
Singer has an entire section where they talk about gay rights, basically in X-Men 2.
Right.
I mean, he has been. I think it's very explicit that there's a lot of civil rights things that happen in these films.
I'm saying they could really make something interesting, and they choose not to.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens here.
Now, here's the thing that I want to point out, getting back to Batman v Superman for just one second, though. I think this is really interesting about Snyder, in that when he puts together something visually, it all has sort of a similar tone, like Watchmen had a...
Right,
It has a very beautiful tone. I don't like the film, but he does capture things cinematically in, I think, what is a very beautiful way, different than I think we've seen the Marvel world.
Sure.
Or,
right.
Yes.
Know, so,
right, yeah.
Am I incorrect in that?
No, you're 100% correct.
No, I mean, Sucker Punch is one of the most gorgeous films you will ever watch.
Right.
You should never watch it.
Right.
I mean, the movie is rancid.
Yeah.
The movie is an abomination. But if you were to just turn off the audio as far as the dialogue is concerned, and you just let the music play and watch the pretty pictures... It's a gorgeous film.
You know,
it's amazingly well composed. It's just a terrible movie.
He reminds me of Michael Bay in a way, where Michael Bay is going to blow stuff up. It's going to look cool.
The
movie might not be great, but the explosions are going to look awesome.
No, the third Transformers movie isn't any good, but the 40-minute stretch where they basically destroy Chicago is amazing.
It's pretty impressive.
It's amazing. I mean, the last Transformers movie was terrible. But that whole chase sequence down the side of a Hong Kong building, apartment building, that was fantastic.
Yeah. So, getting back to comics, increase the superheroes.
I get that comic books and superheroes and all of this, you know, we've had them around. We've had these movies forever.
Right.
But so here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, somebody posted this on Twitter a few days, maybe like last week. And they had this question of, what's your favorite superhero movie that's technically not based on a comic book that is, you know, because you look at some of these films that by all accounts could be interpreted as a superhero movie.
Oh, that's easy for me.
Even though it's not really a comic book film.
That's easy.
And some of the ideas that people came up with were kind of great. And the one that came to mind for me right away, John Woo's Hard Boiled. Chow Yun-Fat in that movie running around at the end of the film carrying a baby under his arm as a hospital explodes and falls apart around him while he's engaging in gunfights. He is a superhero in that movie. He is impervious to gunfire, and he saves babies while doing it.
Okay.
And it is, by and large, a comic book film, but not in a comic book genre.
Okay. Tim, why don't you lay it on us?
It's Fast Five.
Sure.
Fast Five.
Yeah, that's essentially a superhero film. You're right.
The first Fast and Furious movie, they were stealing car parts?
Yep.
They're like a military team saving the world. They're like the Avengers, essentially.
Yeah, basically.
Right. Everyone can fight. Everyone can shoot. Even Ludacris, who was like a mechanic somehow, is like a hacker now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're a superhero team. Okay. My favorite.
You're right.
Two come to mind for me right off the bat. One is a crap film.
Oh, no.
But I enjoyed it.
That's all right.
Even though it was crap. But the other one that's coming to mind right off the bat is The Raid.
Yes.
Sure. Perfect.
Yes.
You know,
perfect example.
And the reason I like The Raid is the fact that it is so intense. For I don't remember how long it was. Is it
2 hours?
2 hours, yeah. And from start to finish, it is nonstop martial arts.
Well, it's the one guy basically surviving all of those
like
fights,
like a video game.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
So I would.
So what's the one that you're? What's your guilty pleasure?
I'm thinking
one?
The Expendables.
Sure. It is. It's a superhero film.
It's a crap film.
Oh yeah.
But it's a superhero film in many regards. Mm. But did it become? Is it based on? Is that one based on?
No.
Is it?
No. Okay. So. Yeah. No. He just. I mean. You could say it's inspired by comic books,
right.
But it's not based on any.
Yeah.
You know, you could make a case that Die Hard is a comic book film. That John McClane is a comic book superhero.
You could make a case it's the best film ever made.
You could. I don't think you would.
I have a question for you,
too.
All right. So with the comic book movies that are left,
uh-huh.
Which one do you think is not going to make it? This is going to fail?
So I mean, but you're asking
Aquaman.
So you're at, so you're asking, you know, what is this year's Fantastic Four?
Just
basically.
Gonna like,
I don't think
critically and financially just
no. I don't think there's anything left this year that will fail.
Yeah,
I think everything that's gonna come out this year. I mean, X-Men's gonna make money.
Yeah,
Civil War is gonna make a lot of money.
All the money.
Doctor Strange is the only one that's a little weird. Just because of the property and the character. But the cast is amazing. And you know what? After Ant-Man, I'm not going to bet against Marvel.
Yeah. That's the other thing Marvel gets right. Like, they cast so well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they really do.
They really nail it.
I think what's going to be interesting is what's going to happen in the wake of Batman versus Superman.
With DC's
I think,
universe?
Yeah. I think Wonder Woman is going to be a hit because it's the one takeaway that everybody agrees on.
They did just enough.
They did just enough that people are excited to watch that movie next July.
And I'm excited the fact that they gave her a chance to hold her own.
Yes.
Yes.
She kicks ass.
She looks good. Not like a weird
But I think that movie's going to...
Good. She's like Wonder Woman.
That movie's going to do well. It's going to be interesting to see... You know, we're making fun of Aquaman right now, but I mean, Jason Momoa looks amazing.
Do you see him working out on Instagram?
I mean, he does look good.
He looks
amazing.
The question still comes up. What does Aquaman do? Go talk to some fish. Awesome.
No, so they sort of redid him in the New 52, and they made him more of like a... He's not the same.
He throws his spear line
anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, and you've got James Wan directing that film, which I think is a good idea. I mean, I think theoretically that movie should be fine, but it's what residual effect does Batman v Superman have on some of these other DC films other than Wonder Woman? I think Wonder Woman's going to be a hit one way or the other.
Uh-huh.
Excellent. Well, so we got to wrap this one up here, you know, but want to make mention of the fact that the Seattle Jewish Film Festival does, in fact, kick off this week, and you want more information about it, you can get it at seattlejewishfilmfestival.org. Tim, what are you working on right now?
Nothing. Got a review for Midnight Special coming this week.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. Always happy to come on.
Always happy to have you back, too. And Sarah, how about you?
So this weekend, I actually have an interview with Jeff Nichols from the writer-director of Midnight Special. I'm going to be having that up on the website at moviefreak.com and also over at the Seattle Gay News. Other than that, I am going to spend my Saturday sitting at home rooting for the Lady Huskies, the University of Washington. First time ever in the Final Four NCAA Women's Basketball Championships. Go Dogs.
Absolutely. And a recap for tonight, Batman v Superman getting one theater, one rent, one skip. My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 getting one rental, one skip. Midnight Special getting three theaters. And Eye in the Sky getting a solid theater recommendation as well. So this has been Cinema Squabble. If you get a chance to give us the thumbs up, the likes, the what have yous on Stitcher or iTunes or even on our own very website, we appreciate it so much. So thank you much for joining us this afternoon, this evening, whenever you may happen to be listening. And thanks much to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer, Tim Hall, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Adam Gerke. We'll catch you next time.
Bow down!